Well, good afternoon. By my watch, it's the appropriate hour to begin. Just a couple of things. We have about an hour here, and we have our presenter, and we have a respondent, and they're going to take some part of that time. There will be time for questions. They tell me, they promise that. They're important. We'd like you to certainly interact with them, talk to them. There will be time, plenty of time for that. Just quickly, as chairman, my name's Jim Dykeman. I'm an anthropologist with Utah Historical Society. I work with Sunstone across the street, so they have me fill in on these, and I was particularly delighted to have a chance to be involved with this. I really enjoyed the paper, and I think you will. The presenter is Dr. Douglas Campbell, and he is a professor of computer science at Brigham Young University. He's involved, I'm just looking at the notes here, with working with software programs, and obviously has an interest in this topic. I asked him if he wanted me to say anything else, and he says, nah, probably the shorter. I think Stan Larson, many of us know, will be commenting on the paper. He's an archivist at the Marriott Library and is intimately involved with historical collections. With that, I'll get out of the way and have our presenter go.
Thank you. Let me give you a brief introduction to the whole thing before I start to read it. If at any point you have questions that cannot wait, a hand flying will certainly suffice. I'm going to tell one story from five different viewpoints. The five different stories or viewpoints are in regards to a scripture that was changed in the Book of Mormon by the First Presidency just a few years ago. The five different stories are, one, restoring a plain and precious truth, two non-LDS Book of Mormon editions, three, Book of Mormon textual variants and printing technologies, four, why not 1852, 1879, 1920, or 1965? And last, well, what about the rest of the Book of Mormon? So with that as the general orientation, I'll begin. In 1981, the First Presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints changed the Book of Mormon scripture, 2 Nephi 30, verse 6, with reference to the Lamanites, from, "In many generations shall not pass away, among them say there shall be a white and delightsome people." It was changed to, "In many generations shall not pass away, among them say they shall be a pure and delightsome people." I present five vignettes as background to this event. Vignette 1, restoring a plain and precious truth. Our story begins with the 1830 first edition of the Book of Mormon. After missionaries had exhausted the first edition, Parley P. Pratt published a second edition in 1837 at Kirtland. Three things then happened 2 years later in 1839 related to our story. One, Joseph Smith sent the Quorum of the Twelve to England. Two, missionary work exhausted the second edition by December 1839. Three, on December 29, 1839, the Nauvoo High Council voted to publish a third edition. After fundraising delays, Ebenezer Robinson published the third edition in October 1840 at Cincinnati, Ohio. In this 1840 edition, for the first time, the text of 2 Nephi 30 and 6 had the Lamanites becoming a pure and delightsome people, rather than a white and delightsome people. That was the third edition. Unaware that a third edition was being planned 4,000 miles away, the transatlantic telegraph wasn't operational until 1866, the Quorum of the Twelve held their April 1840 conference in England, and they voted to publish the Book of Mormon in England by the end of the year. The Twelve faithfully reprinted the 1837 edition. Due to delays, this edition appeared in January 1841. The church had two different editions at the same time, the American 1840 Nauvoo and the English 1841 edition. Based on the English 1841, not the American 1840 edition, three more major Book of Mormons followed, and these were all based on the English version, 1852, 1879, and 1920. A member of the Quorum of the Twelve supervised each major edition. In 1852 was Franklin D. Richards, in 1879 Orson Pratt, and in 1920 James Talmage. The 1830, the 1837, the 1841, the 1852, the 1879, and the 1920 editions kept the 1830 white instead of the 1840 pure in Second Nephi. In the 1970s, the First Presidency established the Scripture Publication Committee of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles. Its charge was to produce printed materials to help people understand the Bible and to prove doctrinal scholarship in the church. Brother Monson, Packer, and McConkie were among its members. A group of faculty members from BYU carried out the project. Among its members were Ellis Rasmussen, Dean of the College of Religion at BYU. During their work, the committee reported the 1840 versus pure versus white Book of Mormon variant. The First Presidency restored this 1840 change to the Book of Mormon in 1981. This plain and precious truth was restored to the Book of Mormon exactly 141 years after it had been restored, but lost. That's vignette number one, appropriate for the church news. Vignette number two non-LDS Book of Mormon editions, 1858 and 1908. Consider three events of 1858 that affect our story. One, Brigham Young, using guerrilla tactics, had earned headlines throughout the East Coast by successfully resisting Johnson's army, which President Buchanan had sent to Utah in 1857. Two, the 28-year non-renewable copyright for the Book of Mormon had expired. Three, hoping to capitalize on public interest in the Utah War, James O. Wright, a non-Mormon publisher in downtown New York City, printed a strictly commercial version of the out-of-copyright Book of Mormon. For unknown reasons, Wright skipped the 1830, 1837, 1841, and 1852 editions and reprinted the 1840 edition with pure, not white. The books didn't sell. This should come as no surprise to anyone who has struggled to give the books away on a mission. Wright should have gotten the advice of Orson Pratt, who had written Brigham Young in September of 1853, quote, "There is no more prospect in offering our publications in the eastern cities than there would be in offering so many cobblestones." Wright had printed, but not bound, 4,000 copies. His Book of Mormon began with an advertisement and a long anti-Mormon introduction on the origins of the Book of Mormon. What could Wright do with 4,000 unbound copies of an anti-Mormon Book of Mormon? Make them pro-Mormon and sell the entire printing to an LDS splinter group. Wright ripped out his long anti-Mormon introduction and had Zadok Brooks, a Mormon elder who controlled the abandoned Kirtland Temple, write a short pro-Mormon introduction. He then sold the entire set of newly bound copies to Russell Huntley, a Mormon, appalled by the Utah Church's emphasis on polygamy. By 1862, the Huntley-Brook faction had disbanded, but the RLDS inherited and used Huntley's copies of the 1840 Book of Mormon for their worship needs. In 1874, the RLDS removed, they needed copies of the Book of Mormon, and what better way to get it than close to the original, these 4,000 copies. So the RLDS bought all the 1840 copies of the Book of Mormon with the pure, not the white. In 1874, the RLDS removed the Brook introduction, faithfully reprinted this 1858, which is the 1840 edition, as the first RLDS version of the Book of Mormon. Skip now to 1906, the year the RLDS decided to print a new edition of the Book of Mormon in response to three events with LDS connections. One, in 1879, Orson Pratt had divided the internal books of the Book of Mormon into shorter chapters. He had divided the long narrative paragraphs into short verses. The LDS Book of Mormon was easier to use. Its verses now looked like Bible verses instead of a novel. Two, when Oliver Cowdery separated from the church in 1838, he kept the printer's manuscript of the Book of Mormon. Now I need to interject one small footnote, so I'll read it fairly quickly. There were two manuscripts for the Book of Mormon. First, there was the copy dictated by Joseph Smith to different scribes. It is a stream of writing with little punctuation, capitalization, or text division. To create a backup for for the printing process, a second copy was made, the printer's manuscript. This copy could be left overnight with the printer, since the original was still in Joseph Smith's possession. In the printer's manuscript, the printer and others marked paragraphs, added punctuation, established capitalization, and cleaned up the grammar. The original copy was placed in the cornerstone of the Nauvoo House, where it was severely damaged. Part of the undamaged original is in the possession of the LDS Church, of the original copy, not the printer's copy. The printer's manuscript was with Oliver Cowdery, who's left the church. Cowdery rejoined the church and the LDS Church on his way to Utah, October 1848. However, before he died at the home of his brother-in-law, David Whitmer, in 1850, he gave it to Whitmer. When Whitmer died in 1888, the printer's manuscript passed to George Schweik, his grandson. In 1901, William F. Benjamin offered it through Samuel Russell to the LDS Church. In a March 1901 letter to Russell, LDS Church President Joseph F. Smith declined to purchase it. Now, there is a footnote. Again, scrounging through the BYU archives. It's a detailed footnote, but I will give it. Quote, this is the letter from President Joseph F. Smith. By the way, the background, of course, is missionaries were slightly different in those days. Brother Russell was a missionary who, on his way to Switzerland, had stopped off, and it was apparently a fairly, you know, relaxed trip to his mission, found out all this information and wrote to President Smith about this, and then was continuing on his mission. And President Smith writes his young missionary friend, "The manuscript in the hands of Mr. Benjamin possesses no value whatever. It has been repeatedly offered to us, and numerous false reports have been put in circulation with regards to our desire to obtain possession of it. But we have at no time regarded it of any value. Neither have we ever offered any money to procure it, all the stories to the contrary notwithstanding, for we have always known it was not the original, as aforesaid, and as many editions of the Book of Mormon have been printed, and tens of thousands of copies of it circulated throughout the world, you can readily perceive that this manuscript is of no value to anyone. There is no principle involved in its possession. There could be nothing lost if it were utterly destroyed. It can neither add or diminish aught from the Word of God, as contained in the printed work which has already gone to the world and has been translated into many languages. Indeed, it is not worth the time and paper I'm using to convey these thoughts to you. Get along with your mission." Well, so the LDS Church did not buy it. But in 1903, the RLDS Church did buy the printer's manuscript from the George Schweik for $22,450. Number three, hope you're not losing track of why we're in this. From 1904 to 1906, the United States Senate conducted hearings to decide whether Reed Smoot, a monogamous Mormon apostle, could serve as senator from Utah. The hearings focused on polygamy, an issue on which the RLDS had extremely strong feelings. So again, the three things were: the Book of Mormon had been changed in its printing by us in 1879. Two, the RLDS had gotten a hold of the printer's manuscript. And three, the Smoot hearings made it so that they wanted to bring up the issue of polygamy all over again. With this background, the RLDS Council of the Twelve charged a committee to produce a new Book of Mormon with better versification, with a text as nearly as possible consistent with the original printer's manuscript. Three, with a restoration of anti-polygamy Book of Mormon verses. The RLDS therefore removed verses from the 1840 edition which weren't in the 1837 version or in the printer's manuscript. In particular, the 1908 RLDS Book of Mormon replaced Pure and Delightsome with the original White and Delightsome. In fact, in their preface to the reader, this change is first among six scriptures restored to their original state. Subsequent RLDS versions have kept this reversion. What irony. The LDS Church had accidentally deleted the verse for 140 years. Her sister church had used the verse for 40 years and then deliberately removed it. That's story number two. Story number three. Book of Mormon textual variants and printing technology. The reader may best understand Book of Mormon textual variants in the 1830, 37, 40, 52, 79, 1920, and 1981 edition by understanding printing technologies. Let's look at each edition in turn. 1830. When the church had exhausted the 5,000 copy 1831 edition, printed by Grannon, why did they produce a second edition? Why didn't they just run off a second printing? To answer these questions, let's review how Egbert Grannon, a small upstate New York printer, did printing in 1830. Grannon set the type for 8 pages, half of a 16-page signature. Proofread these 8 pages while running the 5,000 copies, ran 5,000 copies of the 8-page signature, broke up the signature, and salvaged the type to set the next 8-page signature. Grannon never could issue a second printing. He salvaged its type every 8 pages. 1837. So why does Parley P. Pratt's 1837 Kirtland Book of Mormon have over 3,000 textual changes? The 1837 preface to the Book of Mormon explains, quote, individuals acquainted with book printings are aware of the numerous typographical errors which always occur in manuscript editions. It is only necessary to say that the whole has been carefully reexamined and compared with the original manuscript. Consider 4 simple reasons for textual variations in the second edition of any book, which is both a printer's manuscript and a printed first edition. So this is 1837. You have the original manuscript. You've got the printer's manuscript. You've got the 1830 copy. And now you're getting ready to set the type for the 1837. Time pressures. Scarce money-making resources encourages quick proofreading. An 8-page half signature takes up space in a small print shop. Signatures consume the limited supply of each typeface and font size. The earlier they finish the corrections, the earlier they can print the signature. The earlier they print the signature, the earlier they can salvage the type. The earlier they can salvage the type, the earlier they can accept additional print jobs. The earlier they can accept additional print jobs, the earlier they can make money. Time is money. 2, complicated proofreading. The Book of Mormon proofreaders were not able to line up the old page and the new page and compare line to line and word to word. If you look at the 1830 copy and you look at the 1837 copy, they are a physically different page size, different type size, different width, different height. You cannot line it up because they don't line up. The 1830 Book of Mormon's page height is 15.5 centimeters. The 1837 is 12.5. The 1830 edition has 43 lines to the page. The smaller 1837 edition has 47 lines to the page. The 1830 Book of Mormon width is 9 centimeters. The 1837 is 6.5. The 1830 edition has 60 characters to the line. The 1837 edition averages 54 characters to the line. The minuscule 1837 typeface didn't help one bit either. Beautiful 1830 big, the 1837, you know, people with trifle just cannot read it. Third reason, precedence. When the 1830 printed edition differed from the 1830 printer's manuscript, which took precedence? Even worse, in the years after 1830, Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery recorded some typographical corrections directly on the original printer's manuscript. Thus, the printer's manuscript contained typographical corrections made before the 1830 printing and made after the 1830 printing as they're getting ready to do the 1837 printing. The 1837 text could differ from the 1830 printed version, from the printer's manuscript, from the pre-printing corrections to the printer's manuscript, from the post-printing corrections to the printer's manuscript. And who's going to make the final decision when it's all correlated? And again, it is not Joseph Smith, that he isn't in charge of printing the Book of Mormons, Brother Pratt. 4, modernized language. Joseph Smith modernized Book of Mormon language in the 1837 edition. He changed which to who 707 times. He changed saith and saith to said 229 times. After revising biblical texts, he decided that he had originally overused the term and it came to pass. So on many of the pages of the printer's manuscript can be seen places where, in preparation for the 1837 edition, the phrase was lined out. 1840. The first edition had lasted 7 years, but took 6 months for typesetting and proofreading. The second edition lasted 2 years, but took a whole winter for typesetting and proofreading. To reset the Book of Mormon and to re-proofread for months to print another couple of thousand copies was tedious and time-consuming. Joseph and the Quorum of the Twelves had better things to do than be printers devils. Fortunately, a new technology from England had made its way to the Midwest, stereotyping. In stereotyping, the printer sets the text in type, presses a mat into the type, pours metal into the wetted mat, produces a plate. After the type is salvaged, the plate continues to exist. Stereotyping separated the typesetting process from the printing process. Stereotype plates last a long time, provide economies of scale, permit identical printings of the same edition, and permit printing by different printing companies. In 1852 version, the Nauvoo stereotype plates were lost in the 1846 Exodus. So we had gone to this nice production that was going to last a long time, but in the Exodus, they're lost. But we still have the Quorum of the Twelve over in England, the production facilities over there. Franklin D. Richards arranged for new stereotype plates while presiding in England. For almost 30 years, from 1842 to 1871, the church had the Book of Mormon printed in England and shipped to the United States. 1879. In the early 1870s, the Deseret News Press in Salt Lake City began to assert itself as primary source of printed material for the church. The 1852 stereotype plates were shipped from England to Salt Lake City, but within a few years, the heavily used plates were unusable. Again, technology came to the rescue. England had developed electroplating, so we had stereotyping, now electroplating, to produce longer-lasting plates. But the new plates have to be made from scratch. Elder Orson Pratt went to England to have the plates set again. The church used this opportunity to change the page layout once more. They divided the Book of Mormon internal books into shorter chapters. They divided the long narrative paragraphs into short, memorizable verses. The verses were easier to find. The Book of Mormon looked more like a Bible and less like a novel. New variants crept in when these plates were compared with the 1830, 37, 40, and 52 Book of Mormon editions. 1920. Electroplates don't last forever. 40 years later, these things always happen in 40-year cycles, the First Presidency stated, "So many imprints have been taken from several sets of the old plates that all of these have been defectively worn, and the preparation of a new set of electrotypes was deemed imperative." No new technology was involved in the 1920 edition, but plates had to be made all over again from scratch. The church again used this opportunity to change the page layout. They laid out the verses in double columns, making it look like the King James Bible. A committee under James E. Talmadge was charged with correcting the textual variants. 1981. Printing technology didn't directly change the 1981 Book of Mormon. The 1973 Bible AIDS Project at BYU had created AIDS for the Bible and other LDS scriptures. And a quote from the committee, "It soon became evident that computer assistance in the collection of the information, collating, sorting, and printing the organized data would be helpful. A complete tape file of the standard works had been extremely helpful in speeding up entries, avoiding errors, and reducing the necessity of proofreading." How did this committee, charged with producing biblical aids, get to the Book of Mormon? This is an interesting aside. The Brethren had instructed the Scripture Publication Committee to oversee the edition of A Vision of Joseph F. Smith and A Vision of Joseph Smith to the Pearl of Great Price. They turned to the BYU Bible AIDS Project for the legwork. The BYU committee asked Elder McConkie if they should add footnotes to these revelations, similar to those already used in the triple combination, or should they use a new system that had been devised for the Bible? Elder McConkie was adamant, quote, "Don't use the old Pearl of Great Price cross-reference system. It drives me crazy," unquote. The old triple combination cross-reference system used lowercase letters that weren't tied to a verse. To find the verse to which the cross-reference V corresponded, the reader had to search through the whole chapter looking for the tiny superscripted letter. For elderly people with bifocals or trifocals, this was an infuriating process. With Elder McConkie's encouragement, the committee prepared the two new revelations for inclusion in the Pearl of Great Price under the system that had been established for the Bible. After the work was commenced, the Brethren decided the two visions wouldn't be put in the Pearl of Great Price, but would be put in the DNC instead. Approval was given to redo the entire triple combination with this new cross-referencing system. Early in the project in Bible Age, the faculty committee began to incorporate cross-references to Joseph Smith's inspired translation. Although committee members can no longer recall the exact sequence, at some point the committee had to include Joseph Smith's known revisions of the Book of Mormon. In the course of listing the textual variants, the committee reported the discovery of the 1840 pure versus white variant, and the rest is history. One last footnote in this third story. Considering the extensive use the committee made of computers, and my own interest in the computer science department, I had assumed that the computer technology had led to the discovery of this verse as follows. The committee put the 1830, 1837, 1840, 1852, 1920 editions and the printer's manuscript onto computer tapes. The printer printed out all textual variants, among which the committee found 2 Nephi 30 and 6. Certainly the way I would have done it. I was surprised to learn this was not the case. The LDS Church still hasn't converted these editions to computer tapes to find other variants. The variant had been found by eye. That's the third story. The fourth story. Why didn't this happen in 1852, 1879, 1920, or 1966? I know of no narrative account of the revision process by the people. I know of no narrative account of the revision process by the people in charge of the 1852, 1879, or 1920 editions. Nevertheless, a paper trail exists, one that the reader can verify. We will summarize the Book of Mormon textual variants listed by Jeffrey Holland for selected verses from the 1830, 1837, 1840, 1852, 1879, and 1920 editions. Footnote. Jeffrey Holland, an analysis of selected changes in major editions of the Book of Mormon, 1830 to 1920, thesis, Graduate Studies of Religious Education, BYU, August 1966. So I am firmly indebted to Brother Holland, who did for his thesis all the legwork and recovered the paper trail. 1852. Holland identifies four verses of the 1852 edition which are identical to the 1840 edition, but which aren't in the 1830 or 1837 edition. So the people who revised the 1852 did and were aware of the 1840, because four of the changes made back in the 1852 edition are only in the 1840. And this is from Brother Holland. I want to dodge as much of this as I can. 1879. Holland identifies six verses of the 1879 edition which are identical to the 1840 edition, but which aren't in the 1830. Are not in the 1837, and are not in the 1852 edition, and I list them. He also identifies two verses in the 1879 edition which overturned the 1852 corrections based on the 1840 edition, so they didn't like some of them. 1920, Holland identifies four verses of the 1920 edition which are identical to the 1840 edition, but which aren't in the 1830, 1837, 1837. He also notes that the 1920 edition re-overturned the 1879 editions, overturning the 1852 corrections based on the 1840 edition. I'm sure you're all with me right there. Although only 12 years had passed since the RLDS Church had explicitly listed, I'm sure we've looked at the RLDS edition, the LDS have looked at it, but in the RLDS edition, of the textual variants, one was explicitly listed, and it was. The very first one was the 1840 change. Although only 12 years had passed, this is 1920, had passed since the RLDS Church had explicitly listed the pure versus white variant, the 1920 committee didn't even make a margin entry in the 1920 committee revision of the Book of Mormon. The copy of the Book of Mormon that they used is in the rare book collection at the Book of Mormon at the BYU Library, which has graciously been made available, and you can look at it and see the different things that are marked inside, but that particular verse is not used. Perhaps a perusal of three hymns from the 1927 LDS hymnal can recreate certain cultural attitudes of the period. Oh, stop and tell me, red man, the idle Indian hearts, and quit their savage customs. Great Spirit, listen to the red man's wail. Not many moons shall pass away before the curse of darkness from your skins shall flee. These are separate hymns. In the third hymn, the red untutored Indian seeketh here his rude delights. Perhaps 1920 was not the time to restore the verse. But what about 1966? Could the change have occurred then? On August 5th, 1966, Brother Holland finished his master's thesis at BYU, an analysis of selected changes. Quote from Brother Holland, "This study has been limited to selected changes, defined as major modifications in format and addition, deletion, and change of words within the text which could alter the meaning of the passage. Although Brother Holland examined 156 major Book of Mormon modifications, he makes no mention of the pure versus white variant. Let's consider two factors that may explain this omission by this careful scholar who became president of the Brigham Young University and a member of the First Quorum of 70. As you can see, this paper is grossly outdated now, but we'll continue. One, some members of the Quorum of the Twelve preached a physical change. 6 years before, Joseph Fielding Smith had published, this is in 1960, quote, "When the Lamanites fully repent and sincerely receive the gospel, the Lord has promised to remove the dark skin. Perhaps there are some Lamanites today who are losing the dark pigment. Many of the members of the church among the Catawba Indians of the South could readily pass as of the white race." Two, so there was an existent theology based on physical change by leaders of the church in that time. Two, on May 31st, 1966, 2 months before, the Arizona Republic had run a four-part article on BYU's policy of not recruiting blacks for BYU athletic teams. The 1960s was a time of national concern with civil rights. The church had been under pressure to explain their practice of denying worthy black males the priesthood. The church's official explanation, quote, "We don't know why the policy is enforced," unquote, complicated the university's position. Within days of the Arizona article, BYU's president, Wilkinson, took BYU into a defensive mode. The situation escalated. Stanford, University of Washington refused to play BYU. Major disruptions occurred at Wyoming and Colorado State games. However, the confrontations declined with the appointment of Dallin Oaks as president in 71. Under his leadership, BYU made a concerted effort to stress black civil rights. BYU changed its unwritten athletic policy and actively recruited blacks for BYU athletic teams. In 1974, 8 years after Holland's master's thesis, Stanley R. Lawson, BYU MA thesis, reinvestigated textual Book of Mormon variants. He spent considerable time discussing the pure versus white variant. 4 years later, worthy black males were given the priesthood. 3 years after that, the first presidency replaced white and delightsome with pure and delightsome. That is story number four. Story number five, which I'll have to speed up a bit. What about the rest of the Book of Mormon? While this scripture has changed, people haven't. As I shared these stories, these previous four stories, with people, I repeatedly encountered individuals who quoted, in no uncertain terms, Book of Mormon scriptures that taught, one, righteous Lamanites had their skin changed to white, 3rd Nephi, 2, 15 and 16. Two, Jesus and Mary were white-skinned, 1st Nephi, 3rd Nephi. Three, Gentiles that came to the Americas were white-skinned, 1st Nephi. Four, white skin is physically and spiritually desirable, 2 Nephi, Mormon 9 and 6. 5. In the resurrection, the whiteness of our skins will be an indication of our righteousness, Jacob 3 and 8. Quote, "Ignore the small changes and follow the broad themes of the Book of Mormon," they said. "They counsel me to examine the Book of Mormon." And so I have. As translator, Joseph Smith used the word white, whiter, and whiteness 28 times in the Book of Mormon. I've arranged the 28 references into six usages. One, robes and garments. Two, fruit. Three, stones and hair. Four, Mary and Jesus. Five, Gentiles. Six, white Nephites. The first usage involves clothing, garments, and robes, and I will not read to you. The major number of them have to do with dressed in a white robe, garments are made white, garments were white, dressed in a white robe, etc. These verses suggest that white garments are metaphorical for purity and cleanliness. not literal for color. A physical, the robes are always cleansed in the blood of the Lamb. A physical cleansing agent removes stains, soilings, dirt, disease, and impurities from clothing. Clothing washed in physical blood doesn't appear white. Just as washing clothing in the blood of the Lamb is metaphorical, so whiteness of clothing is a cultural metaphor for cleanliness and purity. The second usage involves fruit. The fruit was white. The fruit was whiteness beyond. The fruit was most precious, sweet above all that was sweet. White fruits are metaphorical for luminosity, not literal for color. Yellow peaches, red apples, green grapes, blue blueberries, oranges, blackberries, purple plums are desirable. A brilliant fruit that glows, dazzles, radiates, and shines is certainly an alluring symbol. But few people like pale, unripe, paper-colored, washed-out, leprous, ashen, or cadaverous-like fruit. The third usage involves stones and hair. Oh, I had as a footnote I put down, I am unaware of any fruit in my supermarket that is white when ripe. And I still am unaware of any fruit that really is of that type. The third usage involves stones and hair. This is the one in ether where the stones are made white, clear even as transparent glass, and the one about the hair, you cannot change one hair black or white. The fourth usage involves two historical personages, Mary and Jesus. Mary was exceedingly fair and white, 1 Nephi. Mary was most beautiful and fair, 1 Nephi. No longer white, she's fair now. 3 Nephi. They were as white as the countenance and also the garments of Jesus, and behold, the whiteness thereof did exceed all the whiteness, yea, there could be nothing upon earth so white as the whiteness thereof. 3 Nephi. And behold, they were white, even as Jesus. I suggest that whiteness for Mary and Jesus is metaphorical for countenance that is exquisite, radiant, awe-inspiring, not literal for blue-eyed, blonde-haired, white-skinned Aryans. Mediterranean people are not Nordic. Jesus and Mary were Mediterranean Jews, perhaps physically similar to present Palestinians and Israeli occupants of Jerusalem. The fifth usage involves Gentiles. 1 Nephi, Gentiles were white, like exceedingly fair and beautiful, like unto my people. The whiteness of the Gentiles is also metaphorical, not a literal skin description. To see this, consider the question, who are the Gentiles in the Book of Mormon? The prophet Mormon gives us an answer on the title page, as did the Jews. Mormon divides the world into two groups, Jews and Gentiles. Gentiles are the non-Jews. Black Africans, brown Hispanics, yellow Vietnamese, black Melanesians, fair-haired Scandinavians, olive-complected Italians are not Jews. Lehi spoke of the Gentiles in 2 Nephi. Wherefore I, Lehi, prophesy according to the Spirit which is in me, that there should be none come into the land save that should be brought by the hand of the Lord. Negro slaves, Vietnamese refugees, the Irish potato famine people, the Japanese sugar boat laborers, the Chinese railroad workers, the Haitian boat people, the El Salvadoran sanctuary refugees have been brought to this land. And none shall come into this land save they should be brought by the hand of the Lord. In what way then are they the Gentiles of 1 Nephi, quote, white, like unto my people before they were slain. Black-skinned Gentiles, brown-skinned Gentiles, yellow-skinned Gentiles, and white-skinned Gentiles are white, like unto the Nephites, in that they have been brought here by the hand of the Lord to become beautiful, pure, and righteous. The sixth usage involves white Nephites. 2 Nephi, as they were white and exceedingly fair and delightsome, that they might not be enticing unto my people, the Lord God did cause a skin of blackness to come upon them. There's one in Jacob, two more in 3 Nephi, talking about the skin of the Nephites being white. Almost through. The white-skinned Nephites and the black-skinned Lamanites are metaphorical for cultures, not literal for skin. The church teaches that the descendants of the Lamanites were the inhabitants of the Americas when Columbus arrived. But Lamanites aren't black-skinned. Lamanites aren't even red-skinned. The skin of blackness is metaphorical. So, too, are the white-skinned Nephites. Perhaps 3 Nephi 2 and 15, in which the Lamanites have the curse taken from them, is a fulfillment of 2 Nephi. In these verses, the Lamanites had the curse taken from them. These are the verses in which the Lamanite has become white and delightsome, not pure and delightsome. I don't think that the Lord changed their physical skin to white in the twinkling of an eye. These Lamanites lived with city-dwelling Nephites and became cultural Nephites. The significance of the third Nephite Lamanites whose skin became white is that the historian of third Nephi, raised in a culture preoccupied by racial differences, records that the Lamanites who could be distinguished from the Nephites on physical grounds were nevertheless numbered among the Nephites. Let's look at two final instances of white in the Book of Mormon, Mormon 9 and 2 Nephi. These verses capture Joseph Smith's cross-cultural translation of white. In Mormon, verse 9, that ye may be found spotless, pure, fair, and white, having been cleansed by the blood of the Lamb. It is Moroni in Mormon 9 and 6 who gives this fervent prayers to what our condition may be on the day of resurrection. Spotless, pure, fair. And in a final attempt to say his heart groans, he adds, white. Not white skin, not Aryan, not Caucasian, but cleansed by the blood of the Lamb. 2 Nephi 26, he denieth none that come unto him, black and white, bond and free, male and female. This verse relates salvation to a set of opposites. Male and female are two sides of the human equation. Neither person is preferred by the Lord. The question of salvation transcends gender. Bond and free are two sides of the human condition. Neither person is preferred by the Lord. The question of salvation transcends social condition. Black and white are two sides of the human condition from the time of Ham, Shem, and Japheth. Neither person is preferred by the Lord. The question of salvation transcends race. It is our culture which has a fixation with skin color. The gospel is intended to overcome our narrow biases. I will... 2 minutes. In the words of Spencer W. Kimball, the president of the LDS Church who approved the Book of Mormon change in 1981, who is known as the Apostle to the Lamanites, who extended the priesthood to black males, in 1954 he gave a conference address, which I urge you to read. It's really quite surprising. In it he has the following quote. From the dawn of history we have seen so-called superior races go down from the heights to the depths in a long parade of exits. Is the implication of Mrs. Anonymous justified that the white race or American people is superior? John the Baptist, in forceful terms, rebuked a similar self-styled superior group. And think not to say from within yourselves, we have Abraham to our father, for I say unto you that God is able of these stones to raise up children unto Abraham. Why this final vignette? Because words aren't static. The meaning and significance of a word can change within a decade. Old meanings of words can hurt. Even when words describe the physical world, they may have associations that go beyond the literal. They may do evil when used unconsciously. I close with the words from a song from South Pacific. You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught.
Well, Doug, excellent job. I think it's good paper, and we've learned a lot. It's been very enlightening, and also a pure discourse. Let's include both of them. One of the things I'd like to just talk about, a few of these things. One that I'll review real quickly is the distinction of the manuscripts and the editions. I think it's already been talked about, but sometimes it's important to keep those straight. The original manuscript of the Book of Mormon was the one written mostly by Oliver Cowdery, as Joseph Smith dictated the text to him. And it's true that most of the pages that are still extant today are in the church archives. The Marriott Library is proud to be the possessor of one half page of the original manuscript. It came from our Frederick Kessler, a Mormon bishop, from his collection, and so we're glad to have that there as one of our precious little gems that we enjoy. Then the printer's manuscript was made as a copy of that was basically the one that was taken to the printer. And then we have, as you know, the 1830 edition that was the first edition, 1833. And there's a lot of interesting things about these different editions, and I think as members of the church, it's there's a perennial interest when you find out that not every manuscript and not every edition of the Book of Mormon of our scriptures have been the same, and there have been changes, and there's a desire to try to understand why. It's true that in the 1837 edition it does mention that there were, as with all first editions, typographical errors, and Doug has been very careful to point out that there were actually some post-1830 changes in the manuscript. And these were probably done in 1836-37 as they were preparing for it, most of which were changing which to who and certain grammatical changes. There were just a few cases where it appears that doctrinal developments since 1830 initiated the change from the Mother of God to the Mother of the Son of God, and things like this. This is obviously something that we can never solve for sure. All we can say is that those were not in the printer's manuscript and were not in the first edition, but those explanations have came in the 1837 edition. The 1840 edition is a very interesting one, and it's in fact the only edition of the Book of Mormon ever published in which Joseph Smith is the translator. Now, you may think I've got it just backwards. But every other edition of the Book of Mormon, except the 1840, that's the only one that says Joseph Smith. All the others, if you notice carefully, it's Joseph Smith Jr. And what happened, it wasn't a very good joke. There's not much of a response here. It's not a joke. It's really true. But what happened is that before the 1840 edition came out, Joseph Smith Sr. had passed away. And so for the first time, the prophet that we refer to as Joseph Smith or Joseph Smith Jr., actually became Joseph Smith. So that's the only edition. It's unique for that, as well as this passage we're looking at about Pure. I think it's also interesting that part of the way times were that a decision could be made in Nauvoo and the need to have a new edition, and it was being worked on. At the same time, the Quorum of the Twelve voted and decided, well, we're out of the Book of Mormon. We've got to get one ready, and they had decided that, and one was published in Nauvoo, and then theirs came out in 1841. So it's part of this, we take so for granted the ability to communicate and in our technology, but it just wasn't that way before, and quirks like this did occur. I think it's also, several details were gone in about the reorganized church edition, and one that I wanted to mention is that 1908 edition where it was referred to as they reintroduced an anti-polygamy statement. They did this quite rightly. In the printer's manuscript at Jacob chapter 2, verse 6, the first edition, the second edition, the Nauvoo edition of 1840, all the others had said, I might testify concerning this iniquity amongst the Lamanites. And the manuscript said, I must testify. So they felt very excited about that, the reorganized church, and they did put that in, but it wasn't something that they did on their own. They did it because the manuscript had said that, and I think that was probably just a lapse on the part of the printer reading it, and it was never caught up until that time. One of the things I find very interesting, and I think we have to keep a distinction between what we feel today in the 1990s and how things were in the 1820s, late 1820s, or the 1830 edition, or the early text of the Book of Mormon that we know. And certainly the point and the implication that's been made here, I think, it needs to be emphasized even more, that with the 1978 revelation giving priesthood to all males, there's still a lot of racial prejudice amongst members of the church. And my mother, one of them, she's a wonderful person, but she's very, very prejudiced, and she grew up with that, and it's hard to change. And I think we need to realize that this is something that we need to address more and more. But having said that, and that's very important, and we could talk a lot about that, still, when you look at the Book of Mormon and some of the passages were has just been discussed, there are, yes, there are metaphorical meanings that aren't literal, but there are also, I think, if you look at the text as it was given, that the curse that was given to the original Lamanites for their disobedience was a real curse. And it involved, in whatever degree of pigmentation, I'm not sure that we'll ever know, there was some kind of a physical, visible change. And the same way, this passage that's been referred to in 3 Nephi was a real change that occurred in the... It says that they'd repented and given up their iniquity, and that their skins changed. The skin color became whiter or lighter. And so something was happening. And I think that, in fairness to the Book of Mormon, we have to look upon that as something visible, especially when they said this was done, so that they could be distinguished. I think we need to realize that there is a place for that there. Also, it's interesting that the very passage that we're looking at here in 2 Nephi, that it says that many generations will not pass away before they will become either white or pure and delightsome. So that, as it's stated in the context, it seems to imply a process over generations, which is not something, if it's a social, a change of lifestyle or knowledge of the gospel and so forth, that's going to occur as soon as the person comes to that point and then immediately for his descendants, but not something over a period of generations. And in fact, it fits in with not too well-known revelation. It wasn't published until just a few decades ago, the 1831 revelation that Joseph Smith received about intermarrying with the Native American Indians, whom they were actually referred in the revelation as the Lamanites and Nephites, not just Lamanites, but Lamanites and Nephites. And this, in the context, was implying polygamous marriages with them. So this wasn't, probably for that reason, it hasn't been well-known, but that was certainly part of the understanding that Joseph Smith had about how, at least one of the possible ways in which a person could become either pure and delightsome or white and delightsome through the generations. I'd like to comment a little bit about this one vignette when Doug asked, well, why not in all these various years listing the years the Book of Mormon came out, and then also 1966, and the answer, Why not 1966, is, as he pointed out, Jeffrey Holland, in his selection of what he thought were the important changes in the Book of Mormon, didn't choose that one. And probably, I don't think, personally, that it was because he knew it, he knew about it, and was abhorrent with this idea about the racial connotations. I think he probably just wasn't aware of it. I don't know. I suppose it's possible to check with him. But it seems to me like it is true that there was some concern, some very real concern, like President Wilkinson working with the Brethren. We have, it's an interesting situation. I mean, I'm a graduate of BYU myself, so I have a great love for the Y. But President Ernest L. Wilkinson, who's was the president of that university, his diaries are unavailable there. You have to come to the University of Utah to use his diaries. We got just about 2 years ago. And so I looked it up, and there's a number of places. He's very, very open about things that were happening amongst the Brethren, with the meeting with the Board of Trustees, other faculty members and everything. But one of the things he said, he recorded what President Harold, Harold B. Lee would have been not the president then, obviously, but this was in the 1960s. But remember the Quorum of the Twelve. Apostle Lee said, I'm going to hold you personally responsible if my granddaughter, who's coming to BYU, if she dates, I think he used the word Negro, but we would say dated a black person. And again, quite open in his diary, President Ernest L. Wilkinson says, and I said right back to him, then you change the policy, because they had a policy and he was following what he was told to do. So there was certainly some deep feelings on this issue. One other thing that hasn't been mentioned yet, but I think it's very important in this particular context and also fills in our understanding of President Hubie Brown. And he was a counselor to David O. McKay, and in the last, probably the last half of the 1960s, that decade when President McKay was no longer able to function, we don't have a term in the church called acting president, but that's essentially what his role was. And during that period, he was able to get approved through the Quorum of the Twelve, a decision, a proposal was made, and it was voted upon and approved that, in fact, this ban against the blacks and the priesthood would be stopped. Unfortunately, and this is in his memoirs, in Hubie Brown's memoirs that were just published a few years ago, Harold B. Lee was not present that particular day. And when he came back, he objected to it and stopped it, so it took another 10 or so years before that happened. So there were these undercurrents in this kind of thing going on. I'd like to finish with just one comment about that. It's actually the first vignette, and it probably wasn't meant to be, I'm not sure whether it was meant to be seriously stated or not, but the comment was made about this verse in 1840 that came out, that it was restoring what was originally there. That is to say that in 1830 and 1837 it had said white, and several generations would pass away before they would become white and delightsome. 1840 it says pure and delightsome. I don't think that we can say that this was restoring something, and the reason for that is that we would have to be able to identify that in fact it was in the original manuscript. There are cases, and we do know that in the 1840 edition, there are probably half a dozen or so. Let's see, one that's quite interesting. See, I don't have these memorized. It's in 1 Nephi chapter 18, in which you remember they're on the sea heading towards the New World, and it says that they were near to be cast with sorrow into Lehi and his wife Sariah, with sorrow into a watery grave. Well, the phrase "with sorrow" is not in the printer's manuscript, the 1837 edition, or the 1830 or 37. It's not in any of those, but it does appear in 1840. And the reason is that phrase is, in fact, in the original manuscript. So there are places. It seems to be only in 1 Nephi, and it was kind of sporadically done, but there are places in 1840 when Joseph Smith actually had something corrected from its presence in the original manuscript of the Book of Mormon. However, there are some places where we know that, in fact, what Joseph Smith was doing was not revising from manuscripts, but rather adding stuff out of the blue because he felt it was necessary. We actually have Ebenezer Robinson that's been mentioned here, was the one involved in the 1840 edition, and he talks about the fact that Joseph Smith told him to add a phrase of explanation. This is actually an understandable thing because he was quoting from a passage in Isaiah that said, or out of the waters of Judah. And he wanted to get across the idea that this referred to, out of the waters of Judah meant baptism. And so Joseph Smith told Ebenezer Robinson to add gratuitously into the 1840 edition, in parentheses, the phrase, or out of the waters of baptism. And so that appears, we know for historical reasons, that was what we might call an explanation at the instigation of Joseph Smith to that passage in the Book of Mormon. So my point is that on this passage here that we've been looking at, we don't know. We don't have the original manuscript for that point, so we can't say that it was either restoring what was in the original manuscript or an addition, an explanation. We just can't say because we just don't have the evidence to do that. So in summation, I'd like to just say that Professor Campbell, you've done an excellent job, and I think we've all been enlightened, and it's been an enjoyable time.
We do have a couple of minutes for questions. If you do have questions, would you please speak loudly and address who you would like to have the answer the question? Sir.
I'd just like to know what the definition of pure is.
Anybody want to try that?
I don't know, but it has fewer suggestions than white.